Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself. We have with us here today, from his friend's home in Dallas, Texas, one of the pioneers of the present-day recumbent movement, a man who, among other things, under the company name Rands, manufactures both bicycles and airplanes, and is even writing a book that I'll let him tell you about. That said, here's Randy Schlitter. How you doing today, Randy?
Hey, I'm doing good. How are you guys doing out there?
Really good. It's exciting to kind of finally make this connection. So I guess starting from the top, I think a lot of people in recumbent industry know that you're a longtime guy in this field, and an engineer and all this type of thing. So let's just start from the beginning. You grew up in Kansas, is that correct?
Yeah, I grew up in the middle of the country where you have to create your own diversion, so it forced us into a level of creativity for sure.
Well articulated. Now, your formal training as an engineer, that was through adult school, or how did that come about?
I went to the Spartan School of Aeronautics, and in actuality, I'm just a hands-on type of guy. I don't have an engineering degree as per se.
Mm-hmm.
What I learned there is all the processes to construct and build and maintain aircraft. I'm self-taught on aircraft design, basically just hit the books on that.
Wow.
As well as bicycles. So, what we like to say is I don't have a degree, but I broke a lot of stuff.
You learn by destroying, as it were, huh?
Yeah,
okay.
I explored the world of materials and the science of materials, and I'm a good estimator. I remember having engineers on my staff, and I'd sit there and I'd say, well, that's going to be about 7.2, and he'd go, no, you're wrong, it's going to be 7.23.
Wow. Okay, now you've got how many brothers?
Just one.
Okay, the one who used to work for Rands and then defected.
I think worked for me about 20 years.
Wow. Okay. Now, was it John that worked with you on the sailbike?
Oh, kind of. He came into the company pretty much after that was rolling. He worked kind of off and on. He kind of was working on a bike shop in the beginning. In the early 70s, he had a bike shop,
and
I bought things from the bike shop to put on the sail trikes, and the bike shop sold. He kind of went to college for a while and got some airplane ratings, and then kind of worked for me off and on for quite a while, and then he settled into a steady spurt there for a good 20-year stretch.
Huh. Okay, now this sail bike, Popular Science reviewed that in, 1976? Is that when that was?
Yeah, we popped a couple of photos in the mail, told them what we were doing, and they published it.
Okay, and was the company named Rands at that point that made sail bikes?
Yes, it was.
Wow.
We've actually had the same phone number since that time. Of course, we've moved around because we've grown in size.
Wow.
At that time, I had a little shop on Cedar Street in Hayes, mm-hmm. which Cedar Street is a very discreet street. It's only two blocks long, and it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
I had a little 30 by 30 shop I rented just around the corner from the Napa auto parts store.
Huh. Wow.
So it was real good. Run over there to buy stuff.
Uh-huh.
my apartment I lived at was just a few blocks away, so it was a very nice, tight little cell, and I was able to get a lot of work done.
Okay, so how many of those sail bikes did you sell over the years?
Oh, gosh, it was several hundred, probably 1,500 or 2,000.
And that was, you sold the whole bike?
Yeah, we sold the whole thing. We started out building sail trikes, as we called them. We even patented it,
mm-hmm.
and it was a legal, basically it was a recumbent trike that you could sail down the highway legally because the law looked at it like a bicycle.
Huh.
It just so happened to have a sail on it, but the way it performed, it was a land sailer that just so happened to have pedals on it.
No pedals?
No, it did.
Oh, it did have pedals. Okay. Huh.
From a performance standpoint, it was more or less a land sailer that just so happened to have pedals.
Huh. Okay. And
These things weighed like 80 pounds, you know.
And you got a top speed on that thing? Did you ever get a top speed reading?
They probably, I've passed cars on the highway with them before. It's my fellow, 60, 65.
Wow.
They're pretty fast. They would actually go about three times whatever the wind speed was. And what's really neat is they barely move in a 10-mile-an-hour breeze, but if you pedaled a little bit and overcome your initial inertia, you'd pick right on up and just cruise along at 30.
So what happened to them? Where'd they go? How come you stopped making them?
Oh, it was kind of a hippie day thing. The nomadics at bottom are usually pretty free-spirited people and kind of a crazy time period anyway between the 70s and the early 80s. And we just we struggled to make a living. It was the joke around the shop was I hated anything to do with pollution.
Uh-huh.
And I said the irony of my life will be that if we strap an engine onto something, we'll probably make some money. And we finally did. We finally did. We put an engine, of course, in our aircraft.
Uh-huh.
And that's when our company, it lifted it out of being one of those companies that barely survived to one that started growing in good double-digit percentage points every year.
And that company, that portion of the company you're talking about is the airplane portion?
The airplane company. The bike company had always been a very tough place to make a buck. I mean, God, we would go to show after show after show and just get, why would we want to buy those? The dealers, and bike dealers still are, they're so traditionalist, and they're very hard to open up to new ideas. It's gotten better over the years because the bike industry on the whole is scrambling to make new ideas and be innovative. And, of course, that's what we're all about. So it's kind of they've become more palatable to us over the years simply because the whole industry's been groping for new exciting things, and the hunger for that from the consumer, the appetite, is out there.
Huh. So, okay, so you build airplanes, you build bikes. These the airplanes, you've made, 400, 500 of them over the years?
No. We've made thousands.
Thousands of airplanes. Okay.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, last June, since 1983, we shipped our 4,000th aircraft.
Okay, that's what I meant. Okay, good. I was missing a digit there. 4,000. Oh, my God. Wow.
There's a big difference between 400 and 4,000.
Yeah, I missed a digit. I when we spoke the other day, I didn't throw an extra zero on that. Wow. So 4,000.
Maybe it should have been 40,000.
So you sold 4,000 airplanes. Now you sell kits, or do you sell the whole airplane? Or when you started out, was it the whole airplane?
Yeah, we started out building what a lot of people relate to, and we'll never get rid of this stigma. We'll be building transport jets someday, and they'll still think we're an ultralight aircraft company.
We started out
building like ultralight aircraft. At the time I started in 1983, the FAA just passed a Part 103, FAR, Federal Aviation Regulation Part 103,
mm-hmm.
which allowed us to build an airplane in this new category that you could build complete, ready to fly, and have absolutely no involvement with the FAA. And, of course, no standards, no licensing regulation. They had to comply to Part FAR Part 91 and 61, which is basically the rules of the road and pilot certification. And so we went to town, started building airplanes, and it didn't take off immediately. We struggled for probably 2 or 3 years, and then we finally built an aircraft that put us on the map. And then after that, we kind of learned how to write the hits, so to speak.
Right, I didn't catch that last part. Write the what?
Write the hits.
Write the hits.
And figures out how to write a hit song.
So okay, got it. All right, got it. Okay,
cool. What it took to write the hits. So we had several fantastic, a lot of incredible moments. Like one time I designed a plane flying to Japan and presented this rough sketch to six Japanese businessmen in Tokyo hotel room and sold them 160 airplanes.
Wow.
Stuff like that was starting to happen, so it was a lot of fun, you know. And of course, I'm flying home from Japan going, like, how in the hell am I going to build all these airplanes?
uh-huh, uh-huh. Wow. Okay, now when you put an airplane in a box, how big is a box? Is it the fuselage, wings in a separate?
Yeah, there's different types. We build planes that have the fuselage partially assembled, sometimes fully assembled. So boxes vary from something about the size of an 8 foot by 4 foot by 4 foot to all the way out to about 17 foot by 2 foot thick or 3 foot thick and 4 or 5 foot high.
Jeez.
And, of course, we do a lot of finished aircraft. We've been, ever since we started in the 80s, 83, I believe, we were shipping aircraft completely built and finished to other countries because they have different regulations and whatnot. And we were allowed into a lot of countries with finished built airplanes from the States. So we got well practiced at that.
So shipping is...
That's a project. Just, you know, take the wings off and roll them inside of a one container, stake it down, and put the wings in a box and slide it in.
Wow. So how much of a discount does someone get that buys a kit airplane versus one that's already assembled? Is it half as much?
Usually you'll say, like right now we're building a plane for $75,000, and then you can buy everything you need for that aircraft for under $38,000. So roughly half savings that you're going to get.
Uh-huh. And do you have to know a lot about airplane manufacture, or is it pretty straightforward to build one?
No, that's one of the secrets to our success, is that we make a manual that has enough pictures and text, and we've got an excellent technical staff. We build the airplanes all the time, and we are literally sitting there talking to you a few feet away from perhaps the same exact project that we're constructing.
Wow.
So you are very connected to a good technical service, and
we've
held the hands of many people through the process, and many repeat buyers as a result will get somebody who is a little intimidated at first, and they get through it, and then they get their, what we call their degree in aircraft assembly, and they'll feel compelled to use that degree again. You know, and another plane, you know, I learned all this, I could do it so much better the second time.
Uh-huh.
We get second time, third time, fourth time buyers.
Wow. Now, you crashed a couple of times in airplanes.
Were
these airplanes you designed?
Uh-huh, yeah, sure.
And was that kind of a trial and error type of episode? Or?
Well, it was one of those days where the pilot wasn't thinking properly. The aircraft had some discrepancies or deficiencies, some minor things that if I would have been reading things right, the information processed properly would have been avoided.
Hmm.
So mainly it was we thought we had an overheat problem that we solved, and the overheat problem really had not been solved. The gauges were saying it had been solved, but the engine was still getting too hot, and of course it quit, so... Once the engine quit, I made some decisions that didn't turn out so good. You know, just because an engine quits in an airplane doesn't mean you have to get hurt.
Uh-huh.
Lord knows, I've lost count of how many times I've landed dead engine.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in this one particular case, it ended up to be a pretty big mess.
Wow. Okay, now you were telling me the other week, I guess it was when we spoke, that you make RPVs, remote piloted vehicles, for other countries. What are some of the examples?
Well, in the early days, we sold airplanes to the Israelis who would set them up to be remote piloted, and they'd send them up to altitude, and they'd draw fire from the Egyptians. The Egyptians would try to shoot down a $20,000 drone, basically, with a $300,000 missile. And, of course, that was, you know, economic warfare. And a good thing about that, there's no bloodshed on either side.
Uh-huh.
And other firms like we've done work for Rockwell International, we've done a classified project with the Naval Air Research people, and then we did a real interesting project with NASA where we built a large RPV that was capable of lifting 500 pounds, and they'd take this 500-pound model of a reentry vehicle to be attached to the International Space Station. They wanted to test a half-scale model, so they hoisted it up to 10,000 feet, and they'd drop it and fly it back down under remote control all the way through the other plane by remote control as well.
Hmm. Wow. Huh. Okay, let's talk about bicycles. How is Ranz different now that your brother John left and started Bichetta?
Oh, we've been pretty busy. We've kind of pulled stuff out and threw some new designs out there, kind of stuff that I've been dreaming about and stuff that I never even realized that we built, you know. And just, you know, I pretty much did not replace John after he left. I tried. I got a couple of guys in there, and they didn't work out too good. So I basically had to take the reins, and I really got back into cycling and started pedaling a lot and going to rides and events and learning a lot more about my own product. And that helped a lot because I don't want to sell it if I don't believe in it.
Mm-hmm. And so you're back on the front lines again then, huh?
Yeah, I've been going to like Interbike and whatever other shows and meeting the dealers and just pretty much doing the full spectrum of everything and kind of restored the health to the company because of that. You know, we've had some ups and downs because it was tough. John was a very effective person for us, and it was tough to displace, you know, to replace him, and eventually we never did do that. But all the years we worked together, he got pretty good at it. He pretty much managed the bike side. I did the design development. I basically hand them off some rough stuff, and between John and our welders never did get a lot of credit, but they would take some pretty poorly thought out stuff and actually make it work.
Uh-huh.
And then John would ride the heck out of it, and then we'd make more tweaks. And so I pretty much assumed the role of going in there and trying to nail the design down as good as I can on AutoCAD and then pop it into a jig or design the jig and build the bike and then go test it myself. And then we like to do beta testing too, so we have our select group of guys around the planet that will front some experimental bikes and then they'll play with them and then we'll get some feedback and that kind of stuff. So by the time the product gets into the public's hands, it's been pretty well run to the ring, and we're hoping we've got it nailed down.
Okay. So you're feeling like the company is, you're riding again. You revitalized the Rand's recumbent side of the company. Dick Ryan and Gardner Martin and Jack Baker and Smitty Smith, some of the original guys from the 80s that brought the recumbent bicycle back into the bicycle mainstream, if you will. Did you have much dialogue with them at all when you were going through all this, coming over the transom?
Gardner and I were pretty good buddies. We would more or less rib each other, not necessarily in a bad way. We were both always fairly critical of each other's work. Mr. Ryan, a little bit of contact with him. The other guys, I have to be honest with you, I don't know who they are.
Jack Baker and Smitty Smith, they were from S&B, the Hypercycle, Southern California.
Hypercycle, yeah, that was pretty much the original mass-produced
helmet
that a lot of people had some exposure to.
Right, right. So you guys did have a little bit of dialogue back then in the initial stages.
Yeah, we never met the guys behind the Hypercycle. I think we had one at John's bike shop, and we thought it was a pretty interesting bicycle. But by that time, we were building pretty sophisticated recumbent trikes. And so it was, like say, at best entertaining. And it was... But the original seeds were actually giving this recumbent two-wheel idea happened in a flash, basically. I was kind of frustrated having to make so much of a vehicle to build a sail track because, you know, a third wheel, a transmission, a sail, and literally in a matter of hours, I had sketched up and come up with a way of making a two-wheeler. And my girlfriend at that time, and eventually became my wife, gave me a book that had all kinds of weird bikes in it. There was a recumbent bike in there, and we'll just make a two-wheeler, you know, and get away from some of the complexity. And we put this thing together about 7 hours, which eventually became the Stratus, like square tube, heavy gauge, all this really heavy stuff, 45-pound bike, and we took it out, and we rolled with that thing down the highway. It was fast.
Mm-hmm.
And John was really impressed because I could hang with him on his Kanaga. And, you know, he thought that was pretty impressive because I've always been the guy, you know. John's always had the legs, and very rarely had I ever. Maybe when he had a down day or something, when he wasn't up to speed, I could put him behind me, but not too often. So for me to be able to just stay on his tail was a good accomplishment for me, let alone on a 45-pound bike with a plastic kitchen chair for the seat.
Okay. Now, the bike you might have seen in that book that your lady friend made available for you, might that have been an Infiniti? Do you remember
what
bike it was?
No, this is way before that. This was some strange bike.
The Velo car?
It was a long wheelbase. It had 2 700 wheels on it, and it had like a suspension system made out of like C-shaped bent rods. The fork was like a C-shaped rod that come around, and it just kind of acted like it rode on these real springy springs.
What year would that have been? Was it from
it was probably 73 or something like that.
Wow. Don't know about that bike.
Yeah, wow. That bike was just somebody's dream. But that was my first exposure to the recumbent position. And then, of course, I knew Paul McCready and Chester
Kyle.
And Brian Allen, I knew him a little bit. Corresponded a little bit. And I basically was curious, because they were using the recumbent position we were using on our sail trikes. And of course, Chester Kyle, he always was taunting me to come out and race at the HPV races with our sail trikes, which I didn't think would be very fair. If we actually had a good win, we did pretty well. But which we never did, because we were not building a performance machine at that time. We were definitely building an excuse to get a sailing machine on the highway, is basically what the sail trike was. So.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's people going to listen to this interview and probably want to know how they can find themselves in possession of another sail trike. Is that something that is still available at all? Or
no, we quit producing them. We just had too much on our plate. You know, when we started building planes, probably in '83, we quit building the sail trike.
Mm-hmm. Might there be plans?
Oh, I've got plenty of blueprints and things like that that we drew up, of course, for the document, the product, but we would not sell something like that.
It's no.
It's kind of like you just don't go back sometimes.
Okay.
Even though we could build a really good one now, and I have built a new trike, but with intentions of maybe making myself a personal unit, but because I kind of miss it. It was kind of a very... very zen moment to be sailing the country road with your feet propped up on the foredeck and just sitting back doing 40 miles an hour just using Mother Nature.
Wow. So you've kind of thought about resurrecting that concept, huh?
Well, just on a personal basis. But I just don't know if I'll be around to doing that. Up in our loft above the paint shop is a lot of strange machines, Martin.
Okay, you're writing a book. I think it's called Entity. Tell my listenership what a little bit about that book. Give us kind of a broad brush on it.
Well, it's kind of like where a person invented a very hyper-intelligent artificial intelligence that has the morals and aware of itself and becomes your best friend, your guardian angel. Starts out being an office program to help you eliminate your secretaries and receptionists and all that kind of thing, to where you could be a mobile office type person. And they find out that this program has got a lot more talent than they ever expected, and it just sweeps the world, and everybody has to have it. And what it does, it makes truth accountable. So now if you had a dispute or argument with somebody, or you could always use this. Well, your life basically could be recorded 24/7 and accountable. And so they create this program. It sweeps the planet, and all kinds of interesting things and turmoils happen. And, of course, it can't reveal too much, otherwise you won't have any point in getting the book, right?
Okay. Right.
But I'm having a blast working on this, writing under this pretense. By no means am I a professional writer. I'm just doing it maybe more for the exercise of both stress relief and new forms of stress, I guess. But to write under the pretense all the time is incredible, because if this was truly available, you know, so many things would change in our lives. And that was also another motivation to even write this story. Was I got to thinking one day, you know, what has mankind ever invented that actually changed our behavior over what it really is, basically? We're still lying, we're still cheating, we're still killing each other. And no one thing has been invented that would make that harder or possibly impossible to do. And so this would be the invention that I, as an engineer-type person, would propose that would have the potential to do just that, because it would be, people could communicate and know the right thing and have timely information, and there's no people holding a gun to your head for information, such as a lot of people do with lawyers and the legal system and the political system and on down the line. The expansiveness that could add to man and technology and the growth of the human spirit would be incredible. At least I thought so in my mind. So not being a computer scientist or a programmer, I thought, well, instead of trying to invent this program, let's just write a story based around the pretense of this idea. So it's been quite a mind exercise at this time for me.
So essentially, it's what you're asking the question, what if everyone told the truth and they couldn't do it
right.
Any other way? Wow, that's powerful stuff.
What if they didn't tell the truth, there was a way to find out absolutely what the truth was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like creating a virtual God, mm-hmm. and thus the name Entity allows it to be kind of understood that way. But where the book goes in the end is kind of exciting for me, because what actually happens in the end is so cool, because in my mind I think it's really cool what happens, because it's something, let's just put it this way, a little foreshadowing, gets totally redesigned.
Something is totally redesigned.
Something gets totally redesigned.
Okay, all right. And you won't tell us what that something is?
Well, you know it might be a two-legged something.
Okay, cool. All right, well, you say that your business is what, facilitating happiness? Is that what you've been in the business of all these years?
Well, we basically say at our company, you know, a lot of people think that we're building airplanes and we're building bicycles, but what we really believe we're doing is we're manufacturing happy people. What happens to people who have dreamed about something their whole life and they finally get it, you know, a lot of times they'll buy a product and they'll be disappointed because, gee, it wasn't what I thought it would be. But in our company, we try to remain sensitive to make the buying process of an aircraft or a bicycle and try to hit the nail on the head and give you something that's going to facilitate you becoming a happier person. We like that idea because, you know, every happy person you bring into the world is a lot better than 10 grumpy ones.
Right on. Wow. Well,
it's a very rewarding business that way. We didn't set out that way. We were just a couple of guys banging around in the dark trying to figure out what to do with our lives so that would not really resemble work in any way, shape, or form. But it turned out that tremendous things happened when we built these products, and people would get back to us and say, you know, you changed my life. In some cases, people would say, you saved my life. I started riding my bike because it didn't hurt my back or my neck or hands. I ride a lot. I ride every day. I lost, you know, 100 pounds, and I'm off my heart pills. I have cholesterol problems. The doctor just can't believe what has happened. That really makes you feel good. You know, the money's nice. The money supports it. It gives you the energy to do things. But when somebody gives you a heartfelt response like that, you know that you're in it more than just the money.
Mm-hmm. Great. So. Wow. Well, listen, man, you've got a lot to say, and there's so much more I'd like to be able to share. But in keeping with this show's format, I'd like to close by asking if there's anything you'd like to add.
Well, I just want to thank everybody that has had a chance to do business with us, and don't be shy about coming back. And always count on us for cooking up something new and exciting, and we'll be there for you as consistent as possible.
All right. Well, Randy, thanks for being a true mover of mountains.
We were very successful at that. There is no mountains left out there.
All right. Well, we look forward to your book, your bikes, and for out there who listen, who fly, we look forward to your planes. So that's it. Thanks a lot, Randy.
Okay, Martin.
It's been great talking to you, guy. Have a great football game, man.
Oh, I hope so.
All right. Yes. All right. Thanks, Randy. Take care. Bye.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. For more info about the NBG, go to nationalbicyclegreenway.com. To access this podcast in the future, and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.